It's noon, it's Tuesday, and Buckmaster isn't here. Bill and his lovely bride have gone off on vacation yet again. This time it's totally inexplicable. They went someplace warm and wet instead of staying here where it's warm and wet in May. I don't know how that happens, but monsoons in May. Anyway, we wish them a very good time on that vacation. And this is Shelley Fishman sitting in today for Bill. And today and next Tuesday, for the entire hour, I am delighted and honored to have two professors from the U of A with me. Professor Brinton Millward is with the U of A, of course, School of Government and Public Policy, and has been a friend of this show and on this show for several times. Likewise, Professor Michael Schaller, who's a Regents Professor Emeritus of History at the U of A. So I have to really keep my act clean and together because these guys know what they're talking about. And I should say at the very beginning that we're going to talk about some fairly controversial stuff. That is, it is not necessarily political, but it's historical. And it talks about the things that various generations of Americans have been experiencing. And as we've moved through those generations, are experiencing somewhat differently, in each couple of years. I will mention that the Buckmaster Show is broadcasting from the Green Things Socolow Village studio, and the Buckmaster Live Line is presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. And that last is very, very important, because as we get into what we're going to get into today, I would like listeners who would like to comment or ask a question of these two guys. You don't always get two professors in the same room that you can ask a question of without paying tuition. And so that live line is 520-790-2040, 520-790-2040. Call in. Our wonderful engineer and producer, John, will take your question. And if you want to be on the air and ask that question, we'll put you in queue. If you want to just ask the question, John will flash it up on the screen and we'll get to it that way. So what is this big, mysterious topic we're going to talk about today? Well, since the end of World War II, and maybe before the end of World War II, many social programs were put in place in this country that richly benefited the generations that were to come. But since the end of World War II, and maybe, if we don't really mark it that way, if we talk about the 1970s and 1980s, some of those benefits have been made harder and harder to come by the American people. And so the stuff that I had growing up, the advantages that I had growing up as, let's call it, an early baby boomer, were taken away. And they were taken away quite deliberately in some cases by my generation and subsequent generations. And, I heard a round table where the baby boomers were being beaten up by the Gen Xers and Yers and millennials, and who were really just beating up on baby boomers. And I couldn't figure it out until they started explaining themselves. And I realized there's a lot to resent. there's the GI Bill that was taken away. There's national service that virtually doesn't exist anymore. There's free public colleges. When I started City College in New York, it was free. Now, I blew it. I flunked out. But that was my fault. Lower mortgage rates, loan guarantees, a whole bunch of stuff. And then just the other day, an essay in the New York Times by Margaret Renkel, she talked about some other things that have been taken away and have changed life for people. Climate change, the loss of biodiversity, gross political polarization, devastating gun violence, social media isolation, reversal of hard-won civil rights, existential threats to our democracy. It's not your fault, she said to a graduating class. And then I said, well, then whose fault is it? Did we screw that up so badly? And apparently we have, or at least That's the premise that we're going to talk about today. So with Doctors Millward and Schaller, and I'm going to take their advice, and from time to time I'll call them Dr. Schaller and Dr. Brinton, or Dr. Millward, but during the course of this conversation, I've been told I'm allowed to call Dr. Millward Brint and Dr. Schaller Mike. So I will. Let's start with you, Brent. What do you think?
Well, I've been called a lot worse things than that, Shelley. One of the things I want to talk about first is listening to the lead up on this. It sounds like the baby boomers have a lot to answer for.
It sure does.
And I'm one of them. I resemble that remark. But the first question that I have is, what is a generation? So there's a technical term, which is it's about 20 to 30 years. It's the time between a birth and the time somebody is starting a family and everything like that. But really, until the 20th and 21st centuries, these labels just did not exist. So one of the thing we're talking about today are labels that are given to differentiate different groups of 20 to 30-year periods. And the question is, what can you say about them? First thing is, they only exist because we've given them a label. Teenagers, for a category, didn't exist until they were labeled in the 1940s and became a popular term in the 1950s. The same was true of baby boomers. There was a baby boom, but baby boomers as a label came later. So the very idea of meaningful generational differences is a controversial one.
But wouldn't you agree that young people have always been viewed by older people as, you know, somewhat rebellious and people who don't necessarily share the values until they
certainly
get to where we are.
Certainly. I don't disagree with that at all. But we've given them many more attributes than just being rebellious. Uh-huh. So the very idea that meaningful generational differences is something like you can tell that someone born on December 31st, 1979, a Gen Xer, associated with disaffection and black turtlenecks, and someone born on January 1st, 1980, a millennial, has an inflated sense of self and an avocado toast addiction. I mean, those are the kinds of differences, gross differences, people use to label different generations.
Okay.
So I'm saying let's take this with a grain of salt. I would like to plug a book for those of you who would like to read about generations. Gene Twenge has been studying generations for over 20 years and has a new book out called Generations, which uses a lot of data to make the case that generations are a real thing. So take a look at that. It's just come out. And I would also like to say that generations are one way of cutting the cake, but so is race, class, and gender. Yet another way is geography. Did boomers in Mississippi experience the 1960s the same way boomers did in California or New York? We need to be careful about painting with too broad a brush.
Okay. I will take that as a caution from the professor, and I fully agree with what you said. However, when I go back to that round table, I am struck by the fact that everybody but the baby boomers on that panel were beaten up on the baby boomers on that panel. They seem to have a sense of resentment that, quite frankly, just, you know, surprised the heck out of me. Mike?
Well, I would say along the lines of what Brent was talking about, the question of what is a generation, these are somewhat arbitrary. But I would say something in addition. There are echoes of generations. So, for example, we use the term the greatest generation to describe the World War II era adults,
right,
either who fought in the war or worked in defense plans or worked on farms feeding everyone, right? But and the benefits they got, the GI Bill, for example. But those benefits didn't just benefit that generation. They benefited
their kids.
Their kids, their grandchildren. You know, I like to give an example of one of the GI Bill benefits was home loans.
Right.
And in terms of my parents, they bought their first home, you know, a Levittown type house.
I get it.
Subdivision. And they traded that up after 10 years. And they traded up again after another 10 years. So I grew up the beneficiary of these. And then they finally sold in the 1990s their last home.
And moved to Florida.
Yeah, well, only 6 months of the year.
Okay.
But, you know, that's an example of the echoes of a program that affected multiple generations. So somebody could resent it, or they could say, you know, that's an example of success.
But at some point it stopped. At some point, those benefits that made it easier for your parents to move to Levittown and my parents to move to Canarsie, no down payment for vets,
right,
very low interest rates, and just then allowed them to raise their kids in such a way that there were some expectations that those kids would get educated, would make use of the stuff that was available in the society. That somehow went away.
But it didn't go away all at once.
Right.
It went away gradually in different ways, in different places. And it certainly had echoes right through the 1960s and early 1970s. You know, be it the GI Bill, or be it National Defense Education Act after Sputnik in the 50s, or the Highway Program, or later Medicare and the expansion, right, of Social Security, and the Great Society. So, you know, I think it's important to look at the long duration of these things.
So when you, and we're going to need to take a break in a couple of seconds here, but when you think of the 1960s, you were a young adult. What jumps out at you for the 1960s that might be a precipitating event?
Well, I think the ability of people of my generation in the mid-60s to go to college.
Okay.
Which had been a rare exception right through the 1950s.
Sure.
Right? And a combination of family resources, state and federal government aid and programs made that a real possibility for almost half, mm-hmm, of my generation's high school graduates, where before it had been 3 or 4%.
Right. Brent, what rings true to you when you think of the 1960s?
Pretty much the same thing. One of the things that struck me is that college was essentially free. I went,
yep,
to the University of Kentucky. It was $300 a semester, and that was for basketball and football tickets and all to using the student union and the gym and everything else, and tuition was free. But here's the difference. The dean would get us out there every freshman year. The freshmen would line up. The dean of the College of Arts and Sciences would say, look around you. Half of you will not be here at the end of the year. There were no remedial programs whatsoever.
Right.
If you were a college graduate, you got in. But nothing was done to make sure that you made it. And the other thing that struck me is it was almost all white and overwhelmingly male.
Yes, yes to all of that. So when I think of the 60s, I took that stuff for granted. I think of assassinations. I think of the Kennedy assassination, the two Kennedy assassinations. I think of Martin Luther King. I think of the shocks that nobody ever prepared me for. And I think that to some extent, the generation, if I may use the term, that followed my generation was conditioned by those shocks. I may be wrong, but that's the thing that struck me as, well, you know, maybe that's what we can blame. Maybe it's that whole idea that we had media, it was reported instantly, it was on television constantly.
So this is the day the music died hypothesis, right?
Okay.
I mean, you've got 63 with Kennedy, you've got 68 with Dr. Martin Luther King.
Right.
And with Bobby Kennedy, I worked for Bobby Kennedy. I was head, mm-hmm, of students for Kennedy at the University of Kentucky.
Right. So let's take a break. Let's noodle on this a little bit. When we come back, I should mention that this portion of the Buckmaster Show is presented by Mona's Danish Bakery, home of the Danish Pringle. Kringle. Danish Kringle. I can get that right. Mona's is located at the northeast corner of Swan and Sunrise, and it's open Tuesday through Sunday for breakfast and lunch. Treat yourself to their mouth-watering pastries, including the famous Danish Kringle. Mona's Danish Bakery.com or BuckmasterShow.com for a link to Mona's Danish Bakery. We're going to take a break now, and we'll be back with these two distinguished professors who are beating up on me about the way to think about this.
Fat Family-owned Jam Culinary Concepts and its family of restaurants has you covered for your special event. Jam caters anytime, anywhere, any size group, and any type of cuisine. Vero Amore, authentic Neapolitan pizza, and Noble Hops. Craft beer and fine fare are synonymous with quality. Call 954-1468 or log on to jamculinaryconcepts.com.
The Regional Transportation Authority's 20-year plan includes roadway, transit, pedestrian, bicycle, and many other transportation improvements across the region. Pima County voters approved the plan in 2006. And the RTA is working with the Citizens Advisory Committee to prepare and present a new draft plan as early as 2023 for public review. Learn more about the process at rtanext.com.
Buckmaster Show listeners know that I'm passionate about travel. When I'm ready to take off on a new adventure, my air travel begins and ends at Tucson International Airport. TUS is nonstop for our community and Southern Arizona. So remember, to fly local, fly Tucson. Tucson International is nonstop for Tucson. More at flytucson.com.
Nestled in the foothills of the Santa Rita Mountains of southeastern Arizona is Equine Voices and Sanctuary. Home to horses and burros that were rescued from neglect, abuse, abandonment, and slaughter. Please consider Equine Voices Rescue and Sanctuary with a financial gift of support and estate remembrance. Learn more about our vision and values at equinevoices.org.
The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The newspapers reach more than 75% of the communities each week, with a combined population of more than 50,000. The Green Valley News also publishes a dozen magazines each year, and both newspapers publish up-to-the-minute local news online at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, it's all right here.
Hi, this is Irene Coppola, President and CEO of the Better Business Bureau serving Southern Arizona. The BBB sets the standards for marketplace trust by engaging with and educating consumers and businesses. The BBB is the resource to turn to for the objective, unbiased information on businesses offering national and local consumer services online and in person. Learn more about the many services offered by the Better Business Bureau at bbb.org.
This is Kate Delaney. Join me tonight for a conversation about what's happening in the world that affects you. Tonight at 10 on 1030 KVOI, The Voice.
And we're back. Shelley Fishman sitting in for Bill Buckmaster with Professor Brenton Millward and Professor Michael Schaller from the U of A talking about the things that generations have experienced and come to take for granted and then have been taken away. And where we left this, just before the break, we were talking about your experience, or our experience, in the 60s, and both professors kind of shared their primary thought process, which was education and the fact that education was free. Mike, say a little bit more about that, because my experience was, that's the way it was.
Right. Well, really, since the passage of GI Bill, and I go back to that as one of the foundational things, creating the notion of mass higher education, which just didn't exist before that, right? Brent and I were talking about this week. It was something like 3% of Americans went to college or had a degree before World War II.
Right.
And a lot of that was religious schools or normal teaching colleges, things like that. It just revolutionized the GI generation coming back to both colleges and trade technical schools. And the expectation of that as normal certainly carried over to their children. My parents
absolutely.
My parents didn't go to college. They were barely high school graduates. But their expectation was I would. And I could because the state system in New York where I went, like Brent was talking about, Kentucky, was close to free, right? Close to it. And that was a remarkable generational change. for me and millions of other kids.
But when I was applying to City College, there were certain very strict requirements in terms of what my grade point average was, that I had taken certain prerequisites, etc. So it was free, but it wasn't necessarily open for all.
Right.
Well, but Kentucky was different in many ways than New York. But there, as long as you were a high school graduate, you could come to the University of Kentucky or any other state school, and for about $300 a semester, you were enrolled. The difference was that half of those people who came in their freshman year were not there in the sophomore year. They flunked out. They didn't come back. They tried it for a while and said, "This is not for me." So, I mean, it was not a world that welcomed people,
right,
who did not have the kind of education or the kinds of family support that other people did.
Mike, a little bit more about that. I'm interested because I think our experience in the Northeast was a little different.
Well, it was different, in just as in California, it was different with a large community college system and state college.
Right.
In New York, which I knew best, there were, before World War II, before the GI generation, there was almost no state higher education. There were a lot of little private liberal arts colleges,
right?
And seminaries and teachers' colleges, but not a large liberal arts system. It relied on the city college system, as you were talking about.
And a community college system that supported it.
Right, but there wasn't much of a community college system before the 1960s.
The
Bronx Community College and others. Those were, I'm not exact sure when they came into existence, but they were not there before the 60s to any large extent. But what New York had that was different was they did have a state requirement, Regents Diploma.
Absolutely.
Which was a prerequisite for getting into either the city colleges or the state university system where I
went. Until some point in time,
but didn't change really until the 1970s,
right.
Some point in the 1970s.
So how much student debt did you have to deal with when you graduated?
From college, virtually none.
And you, Brent?
Not only did I not have any when I graduated from my baccalaureate degree, but I got a master's and a PhD from Ohio State University, and they paid me to go there. So, I mean, it was terrific. It was wonderful. I got my PhD from Ohio State, and the only thing that I really was upset about is they had their own airport, and I wish I'd taken flying lessons and gotten my license. I could have done that free.
So someone in a later generation, let's not name it, or delineate it, who has graduated with a master's degree or a doctoral degree and $200,000 worth of student loan debt, how do they relate to us?
People from the moon.
Yeah.
Well, like Brent, I went to graduate school after my BA degree from 1968 to 74. That was 6 years, okay? I paid for 1 year, my first year, till I sort of qualified to get support. And it was a combination of state and federal support, that basically paid for 5 of my 6 years to getting a PhD. So I came out, again, with minimal debt, a few $1,000s.
So one of the things that the two of you have in common is that once you started your post-high school education, you stayed in the system until you had the degrees that you wanted.
Correct.
Yes.
Okay. So my experience is a little different, partially because I flunked out after 1 year. And I was just too young and was into opera singing and that kind of thing. But when I joined the company, and I'm going to change the subject on you a little bit, joined the company, and that company decided maybe I was a keeper, even though I didn't have a college degree, they pretty much dragged me kicking and screaming back to college and paid that $15 a credit tuition until I had 7 or 8 years later a college degree, and then started asking, well, you know, when are you going to get your MBA? And so they paid for that too, and I got my MBA. And then, you know, somebody actually asked the question, well, when are you going to get your doctor of professional studies? And I started that on their dime until they promoted me and sent me out to New Jersey, and I couldn't do everything. So I just settled for the MBA. But my experience, again, as yours, was I had no debt. It was my company had enough faith in me to want to keep me as trained as possible so that I could help the company long term.
I think one thing I'd like to emphasize at this point, what we experienced at all there roughly the same time, was there was a huge institutional building program going on. When I first got to the University of Kentucky, there were still Quonset huts and sort of temporary buildings right. from World War II that they put up to get the GIs through after the war. Money was coming in from big science was big, and the federal government was putting an enormous amount of money into colleges and universities.
Let's pick
and
this
state
up.
Legislatures.
Let's pick it up because clearly the percentage of college-educated people grew as a result of
exactly.
all of this happening. We're going to have to take a break in a minute, and I should say that our friends over in Silver City and Grand County are ready and welcome to welcome you back with open arms just 3 hours east of Tucson. There's so much to do in Silver City and Grand County, New Mexico, including hiking in the Gila National Wilderness, where there's plenty of social distancing, and visiting the world-famous Cliff Dwellings National Monument. For a complete listing of the many things to do and the great places to stay, visit southwestnewmexico.org. So what we're going to do is we're going to break here for the half hour and be back with these two distinguished professors who are just having a good time telling me how our experiences are both the same and in other ways very different.
Dine in or take out authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza at Vero Amore, where every flavorful pizza, pasta, and panini are homemade using the finest local and imported ingredients. Vero Amore, Plaza Palomino at Swan and Fort Lowell, and on Dove Mountain in Marana, plus a full catering menu and mobile pizza truck for parties and events. Vero Amore, on the web at veroamorepizza.com. The nonprofit Tucson Wildlife Center has been helping injured, sick, and orphan wildlife in southern Arizona since 1999. They're dedicated to the rescue, medical care, and rehabilitation of sick, injured, and orphan wildlife, with the goal of releasing them back to their natural habitat. Around 5,000 animals a year come to them, as they are the only wildlife rescue in southern Arizona. All made possible through donations. They receive no government funding. Please donate at TucsonWildlife.com.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. Have your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and penal politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
For more than a half century, Tucson Gardeners Trust Green Things, a family-owned and operated retail and wholesale plant nursery, offering an amazing variety of plants, trees, cacti, pottery, and so much more, all at great prices. The 13.5-acre site by the Rito River is also home to the Zocalo Village, specializing in fine Mexican and Latin American imported furniture and art. Green Things open daily at 3384 East River Road and at greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com.
Cushman & Wakefield PICOR is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield PICOR offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial, office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at PICOR.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's PICOR.com. Call us at 748-7100.
Have you always wanted to cruise to Alaska? If that's the case, then you'll only see the tip of the iceberg. At Bon Voyage Travel, we can package the full Alaska experience with a cruise tour. Journey to Denali National Park on glass-domed rail cars. Tour the tundra wilderness and see the northern lights with an expert guide. And of course, relax on your cruise as you enjoy the glaciers up close and personal. Go to bvtravel.com today. Bon Voyage Travel, your Alaska experts.
Okay, we're back. Shelley Fishman sitting in for Bill Buckmaster, who is on vacation with Professors Brenton Millward and Michael Schaller, talking about education and generations and what we as baby boomers grew up with that today's generations, however you define them, don't really have. And when we went to break, Brent, you were talking a little bit about in Kentucky how the need for colleges and growth in colleges made such a big difference to what people's expectations were.
It had a huge impact. I mean, you had Kentucky is sort of a microcosm for the rest of the country. Before the war, you really had two universities, and you had a number of teachers' colleges, sort of normal schools. And those all became universities, Eastern, Western, Northern, Murray State, all those became universities during the 1960s. And they came about because of huge demand on the part of a generation. We've talked about this before, but 73 million people in the baby boom generation, half of the population of the United States before in 1945. Also, the Cold War. War is good, or at least it was very good to education. The space race, Sputnik, all of that saw money coming in for education, for research, and really created mega universities all across the country.
So public policy has a great deal of influence on how educators, builders, people who need to first feel the demand before they can, you know, invest in the supply. But what you're saying is post-World War II, that demand was so insistent that there was no way to avoid allowing the capacity to be there, but also somehow promoting the population to fill up that capacity.
Right.
But politics was also a problem. You might say the need for expanded educational system was obvious. The need for better roads and transportation was obvious. Nobody would disagree. What they disagreed intensely on was how to fund it,
okay,
and how to support it. So take roads, for example. America, you know, barely had a national highway system, Route 66,
right,
you know, a few other trunk roads. But nobody could agree. Everybody agreed with the automobile age and the relative decline of railroads. You needed a transportation system. How did it pay for it? Should it be tolls, like a, you know,
and there was some of that.
There was some of that. Should it be through excise taxes? Should it be general revenues? Nobody could agree. And there were studies, big commissions, and everybody agreed on the need, but nobody could agree on how to do it. Until somebody said, let's sell it as a defense program.
Okay? A Republican president, as a matter of fact.
That's right, Dwight Eisenhower. And he said, let's call it the National System of Defense Highways.
Right.
Okay? You put the D in there, and the argument was supposedly you could evacuate cities on modern freeways. Right. You know, in 18 minutes, you'll evacuate Los Angeles. But it transcended Democratic and Republican and rural and urban divides. And it was a similar thing with education. There, as Brent was mentioning, this huge cohort of kids, the baby boomer generation, and new communities, subdivisions all over the country, and it wasn't building a classroom, but building whole new school systems.
Right.
Everybody agreed it was necessary. How do you fund it?
Right. Okay? And that's the question.
Right.
Still today, depends.
Yes, sure.
Regardless.
And Democrats and Republicans, North and South, bickered. Should again. What about aid to parochial schools? What about integration? All these things until Sputnik went up in October
of 57. And then everybody agreed.
National Defense Education
Act. There you go.
Right?
So I'm going to interrupt because I just want to remind people of the Buckmaster Live Line. It's presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate, and we have somebody on that live line right now. Just to give everybody the number again, 520-790-2040. And Chuck, we've got some comments from Chuck on the air.
Thank you, gentlemen, for taking my call. I overheard you earlier in the program mention the fact that most of the college-age students coming into going to college were all males, maybe 95%. And there was a very good reason for that. You've got to remember, we had such a thing called the draft going on. And there were only two ways that I know of that you could get out of the, or at least be deferred, was one, you were married and had children, or the second one was to go to college and you received a deferment. And this was to a large degree, why so many guys went into the college.
Absolutely.
Really Chuck, should never be.
Chuck, yeah. That's a really good question. Let's talk about that a little bit. Thank you for the question. The question, we had some trouble with earphones here, but the question was in response to saying that so much of the college population was male, was because of the draft. And that was a way people got out of the draft. Now, I'll tell a little story pretty quickly. You know, when I flunked out of college, I was draft bait. I was 1A. Now, I found a way that Chuck didn't mention for not going to Vietnam. I joined the Marine Corps, which is, you know, somewhat oxymoronic, but I got into the reserves, and it kept me out of the war. But what about that comment?
Well, I think that's a very interesting comment. The draft was certainly central to my experience in college.
Sure.
I can remember, again, this is early on in Vietnam. This is about 1966. I can remember having to sit for an exam at my university to prove that I was smart enough to keep my deferment. And I think they only did this maybe once or twice, and I'm not sure whether it was Selective Service System, whether it was the Armed Forces, or who did it. But basically, you had to score at a certain level if you were going to keep your deferment. I think they only did that once, and then they went to the lottery after that. But, I mean, the draft was a very, very big deal. I would not think that the draft was the big motivating factor for men to go to school during the 1950s and early on in the 1960s.
Until the war.
And, you know, as Vietnam heats up, people came up with all kinds of ways.
Mike, you're shaking your head.
Well, because it's a yes and no answer. Certainly some. But as Brent said, almost any college student got a deferment till around 1966. And then, as Brent noted, there was a grade threshold. Where I was, it wasn't a standard exam you had to pass, but you had to have close to a B average.
Is that right? I don't remember that.
Yes. And, of course, I would say it didn't so much lead to enrollment as grade inflation. I was clearly going to get a C in German, my language requirement, and I spoke to the teacher, who was a very sweet woman, who herself was a World War II-era refugee, and I said, I won't see you next semester, Frau Stein, because she said, why? You're going to pass. I said, I know, but I'll only get a C, and I'll probably be drafted. She said, don't worry. And, of course, I got a B, and I still feel guilty today about that. But I don't think overall that, you know, suggested what the numbers were. I think on the margins that did drive some people to college. But I don't think, just given the size of the cohort in the 1960s.
It couldn't have all been draft eligible.
Right, right.
And then at the end of your college, if you weren't married with a kid, you were so 1A again.
Right. And graduate school generally didn't give you a deferment.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I had to go for a draft physical, and knock wood, I failed.
How perverse is that? I get it. I still have the letter. Greetings.
But one thing we haven't talked about that relates, we're talking all around it, is, of course, the Vietnam War.
Sure.
You know, and its effect on a generation and on American politics, sort of the crisis of liberalism and, you know, the ascendance of conservatism.
You know what? That's a great place to take a break because I want to come back and talk about the Vietnam War and the effect that had on how things changed. You know, Since then, and I'm going to read an ad now because, you know, we ain't got to pay the bills, but since 1970, Green Things has been the go-to place for your gardening needs. Green Things is on a lovely 13-acre site that is also home to the Socolo Village and all of those fine Mexican and Latin American imported furniture and art. Green Things on River Road, just west of the Brandy Fenton Park, and on the web at greenthingsarizona.com. That's greenthingsaz.com and socolovillage.com. And with that said, we will take a break and come back and talk about the Vietnam War.
Noble Hops is Tucson's original gastropub, serving an ever-changing menu of craft beer and fine fare. Savor the majestic mountain views from the perfect for any season spacious patio at West Lambert Lane and North La Cañada Drive in Oro Valley. Order in or take out at Noble Hops, a pub for foodies. On the web at noblehops.com. The Regional Transportation Authority plan is funded by a voter-approved half-cent sales tax. The RTA tax is collected throughout Pima County and averages about $100 million in revenue each month. The RTA is the largest annual funder of regional transportation projects in the region. The RTA tax funds priority projects that were approved by voters in 2006. See details in the latest RTA annual report at rtamobility.com.
At Tucson International Airport, we are nonstop for our community. Our main priorities are providing a safe and secure travel experience and excellent customer service. We're also nonstop for landing prosperity in Southern Arizona by attracting new flights for business travel and family getaways. When your airport thrives, our community thrives. So fly local, fly TUS. Tucson International Airport is nonstop for Tucson.
Family owned and run since 1985, Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing is the gold standard for quality and professionalism for picture framing, custom frame mirrors, art for your walls, and hanging and lighting solutions. Come in for your design session or set it up electronically. Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, Fort Lowell and Dodge, and now doing e-commerce at moesgallery.com.
The Friends of Pima Animal Care Center is the nonprofit partner to our Pima County Animal Shelter. We grant critically needed resources to PACC so that it can continue the amazing life-saving progress it has made in recent years. Your generosity helps us find homes for abused, neglected, and abandoned animals at PAC. Learn how you can help at friendsofpacc.org.
This is Bill Buckmaster urging my listeners to join me in becoming a member of the Reed Park Zoo, one of America's top zoos and home to more than 300 animals from all over the world. When you become a zoo member, you receive free daytime admission, discounts on special events and education programs, and so much more. Find out more about zoo membership and everything you need to know about your zoo visit, reedparkzoo.org.
You're listening to Bill Buckmaster. The Ramsey Show is coming up at 1 on AM 1030 KVOI, Cortero, Tucson, The Voice.
And we're back live. This is Shelley Fishman filling in for Bill Buckmaster at the broadcasting from the Green Thing Zocalo Village Studio here in Tucson. And I just want to remind everybody that the KVOI and the Buckmaster live line number is 520-790-2040. We're going to be talking about the Vietnam War and its effects on education and the generations that followed, the boomer generation. So we're here again with Professor Brinton Millward and Professor Michael Schaller from the U of A, both historians and social scientists. And I just found out that, Mike, you taught a course at the U of A for 30 years on the Vietnam War. So
yes.
Let's start with you.
Okay. Well, yeah, the course I taught was not military focused. It was really the politics and diplomacy of the war and how it and American society. And one of the things I think it's important to say is one of the casualties of the Vietnam War, besides those killed or injured
among
Americans and Vietnamese was liberalism in some ways, where, you know, Johnson's Great Society programs, anti-poverty programs, civil rights programs, educational expansion of social services, those were casualties as in the field of Vietnam as well as human bodies. And it's sort of, to many Americans, it seemed, coming up after the assassinations you talked about.
Right.
President Kennedy, then Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, the war in Vietnam, dissent. It seemed to say that liberalism, you know, as born in the New Deal and moving forward, had run out of gas. You know, it was no longer an answer to America's problems. And by 1968, you know, the rise of Richard Nixon in the polls was a result of Vietnam. Nixon was not as conservative.
A secret plan to fix it. Yeah.
Now, domestically, Nixon was, besides his criminality, in terms of social programs, was not as conservative as we think. He'd probably be considered a liberal Democrat today. But liberalism, as classic liberalism of the New Deal variety, really met its end in large part in Vietnam.
Sure. Let's take a comment from the live line. Lawrence has something to say about the lottery system for the draft.
Yes, sir, gentlemen, that's me. This is not funny. It's funny, but not funny. My answer to avoiding the draft was to enlist. And guess what? I enlisted, and guess where I went? Vietnam. Now, I was graduating high school here in Tucson, June of 66. And it occurred to me I was ripe for the taking. And I thought, oh, no, what am I going to do? I wasn't in college until I came back from Vietnam. But I don't recall the specifics of the lottery system. Can you possibly explain
the lottery system?
Was it a numbering system based on your birth date or something?
Yes, sure. It was the lottery.
Thanks for that question, Lawrence. Mike?
Yes. First of all, it didn't apply to you because in 1966 it didn't exist.
Right.
Didn't exist till 1970-71 under Nixon. Okay? He started the lottery system. Before that, it was the selective service system, each community coming up with its quota. But the way the lottery worked when it was instituted was every birth date, January 1st, 1970 and so forth, was given a random number. So January 1st might be number 300. Okay, January 2nd might be number 2, okay, in priority.
Well, that's why it was a lottery.
Yeah. But it gave you a planning strategy because they only needed to draft, especially after 1970 as the draft calls went down, up to about 120, 130. So if your birth date put you at number 300, you were home free because you were only eligible 1 year.
Right. Okay?
So you just were born too early. If you maybe had the wrong birthday. And from 1970 on, you could have known at the beginning of the year what your eligibility was.
Now, we've lost our caller, but I'd be interested because he was in the Army for several years and in Vietnam. So when he got back, Lawrence, when you got back, did you have the GI Bill to support your tuitions? After that. Oh, he's still on. That's great. Lawrence, did you make use of the GI Bill when you got back and out of the service?
I did. I did. I thought you said you lost the caller. I did. I came home and I went to the U of A. That was amazing because I enrolled at the U of A, I think, end of 1974, the last semester. And you know what? The tuition down there was $175 for my first semester.
Yeah, yeah. So that kind of – congratulations, I mean, to have gone through the service and then back to college. That's great. Thank you again for the call, Lawrence. So what we're seeing here as we draw close to the end of our first hour, because we're going to do this again next week – is that if you take a snapshot of the world today and you take a snapshot of the world we grew up in up till about the end of the Vietnam War, things looked very, very different.
Well, I think they did. And all kinds of things changed. I mean, we were no longer, as a country, without competitors in the world. I mean, there's this baby boom generation. There are other generations coming along. But there's a lot of other stuff going on too. There's the Cold War.
Sure.
And as Michael has said, you know, this was Sputnik and the threat of communism was a great boon for building all kinds of infrastructure, including this interstate highway system, colleges and universities, that the baby boom generation and others following them benefited from. But competition-wise, the rest of the world was catching up. The world that had been devastated was now competing with us. And this is a theme that I think maybe next week we can carry on as you see the rise of China, the rise of the European Union. And these are economic competitors for jobs, for products, for all kinds of things.
So it changed the world structure economically, but it also changed the structure of the economy, the macro economy here in the United States, so that the middle class possibilities that you might have had growing up in the 30s, a good job at General Motors and 40 years and a gold wristwatch, all of a sudden maybe that wasn't so possible in a lot of the country.
What was happening, as Brent suggested, was the moving offshore of basic manufacturing.
Right.
Cars. I mean, you know, up until the early 70s, you know, the idea of a German or Japanese car was exotic. But by the mid-70s, it was a norm, right? So auto manufacturing is living, steel manufacturing, appliances, all of these that were solid, you know, working middle-class jobs are moving offshore as the rest of the world develops. China's not yet a factor until,
right,
you know, about 20 years ago. But Japan is, Europe, Western Europe is. And those have profound changes. If you look at income distribution in the U.S., you know, for the working class and lower middle class, it sort of flatlines
in
the 70s.
The 70s are a period of high inflation.
Right.
And a great deal of dissatisfaction with government in general and liberalism,
yeah,
specifically. And especially there was this whole Beat Generation,
right,
that was rubbing it in the faces,
right,
of people who just, you know, expected people to bathe every day.
To digress for a second, since you mentioned, okay, inflation, which really only becomes an issue in the late 70s and early 80s, we need to keep a little historical perspective. Inflation now, which is a hot political issue, is less than half it was at the end of the Reagan years.
Yeah. Right.
You know, when nobody described it as a problem.
Well, right. I mean, my first mortgage when we moved out of a rental apartment into a condo in New York was at 12%.
Yeah.
And we thought that was normal. But the idea that something happened between 1970 and maybe 1983, 1984, or some set of things happened that really changed the way we expected people to enter the middle class, the way we paid for it, and the rewards that came from being a citizen changed massively.
Sure.
It did. And you had, this was the period of stagflation.
Yep.
And Jimmy Carter, you know, he had his challenges with a number of things, the Iranian hostage crisis and the end of the Vietnam War would have been under Ford, is that,
yeah,
right?
74, 75.
But, you know, a lot of shocks, both internationally, to the psyche of the country, and also to the economy.
And remember the most remembered line of Reagan's inauguration, government isn't the solution, government
the
is
problem.
The problem.
Right.
And that really marked a sea change.
It's a demarcation between...
Yeah. Yeah. Gentlemen, this has been, you know, a full hour, except it seems like it was only 3 or 4 minutes long, and we're going to do it again next week. So I would like to thank you both for, first of all, being here and for bringing, I think, a perspective that most people don't have, a more academic perspective to what could have, you know, become just a discussion about politics and policies. I really appreciate it. Next week, we're going to continue this and maybe take it past the 1980s and see what's happened. Again, thank you, Professor Millward, Professor Schaller. If Bill Buckmaster, if you're listening somewhere, have a great vacation, and we'll be back next week with the same two gentlemen and continue the discussion.